I'd like to open the Senate Education General Government Committee. We'll start today with a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 38. Senator Devlin, 2 days in a row, is here before us. Dana, would you like to...
Sure. Senate Joint Resolution 38 proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution that would require the Legislative Assembly to appropriate each biennium a sum of money sufficient to ensure that the state's system of public education meets the quality goals established by law. So this is the ballot measure one piece. It provides for stepped percentage increases in meeting 100% funding, and it does have a subsequent referral to rules.
Senator Devlin.
For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Mr. Chairman, thank you for giving SJR 38 a hearing. And Chairman Haas and members of the Education Committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak about this resolution. First, let me start by answering the question, why is this constitutional amendment before you, and why now? I think that's a very appropriate question to ask, particularly given the fact of our current circumstances. We all know that our resources currently, by our latest forecasts, fall $3.1 billion below what would be necessary to continue our existing service levels. We anticipate those levels to go to $4.4 billion, and many of us believe that those numbers will even get worse than that. When I wrote this yesterday, the unemployment rate was 10.8%. As you all heard this morning, the unemployment rate has now risen to 12.1%. So over a period of a few months, it's went to 9.9, 10.8, 12.1. Businesses are laying off employees or closing. In the next 11 weeks, we will pass major budgets in education, human services, and public safety and other areas that will be far below what we believe essential budget level or current service level is for those budgets. So why now this resolution? Primarily because I believe as we concentrate on the present and worry about how we are going to deliver even essential core services, we should not lose sight of the future. I believe the quality of public education delivered, whether PK-12, community colleges, or higher ed, Head Start, will have a greater impact on the economic, social, and cultural future of this state than any other investment that we can make. I do not believe that education funding in this state has been adequate or sustainable any time during my 56-year lifetime. Some will live in the past and blame Measure 5, but pre-Measure 5, Oregon was a state with some adequately funded schools, some marginally funded schools, and many poorly funded schools. In 1997, the Quality Education Commission was created. Since that time, the quality education model was developed and revised biennially. The QEM, as it's called, is a best practices model based on professional judgment of resources required to meet specific education goals. Since its inception, many have been critical of the QEM overall funding requirements, believing them to be unrealistic. But the QEM is actually more of a roadmap to improve performance than an absolute requirement. I actually have some pages here, but I just thought I'd reference just a few things because everybody thinks that the QEM is rocket science. And actually what it's largely talking about is class sizes, specialists in certain areas, counselors, the amount of money that's available for books, the amount of money that's available for materials. It's actually a relatively straightforward. Is it a perfect model? No, but it's the model that we use currently. In the November 2000 general election, the voters of the state adopted Ballot Measure 1, a constitutional amendment that became Article 8, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. The relevant part of Article 8, Section 8 provides that the Legislative Assembly shall appropriate in each biennium a sum of money sufficient to ensure that the state system of public education meets quality goals established by law, and publish a report that either demonstrates the appropriation is sufficient or identifies the reasons for the insufficiency, its extent, and its impact on the ability of the state system of public education to meet those goals. In January of this year, the Oregon Supreme Court issued an opinion in Pendleton versus the state of Oregon. We all know what that position held, but I'll give you my short summary. You can disagree with the short summary, but I think this is basically what it held. It held that the legislature had failed to meet its funding obligations under Article 8, Section 8. but it agreed with the state position that the state could meet the constitutional requirement if they explained why they were unable to meet the funding goals. So if you file the explanation, you basically have no reason to actually have to meet the goals as long as you have an explanation. The purpose of SGR 38 is to take away that argument by the state, that all that has to be done was to explain why funding goals were not met and replace this requirement with specific floor levels required over a reasonable period of time. There are still some serious issues over whether these requirements are enforceable, even as this constitutional amendment is written, given particularly some very significant separations of powers issues. Before I close, I would like to offer a few observations about K through 12 funding over the last 12 years. School funding, as we all know, includes state, local, and federal funding. However, as we know, federal funding largely benefits specific students. State funding, as compared to local funding, has varied between 72% and 68% of the total of state and local funding. One of the things that I always kind of concentrate on when thinking about particularly K through 12 is we're talking about a system with 564,000 students, depending upon how you consider them, about 200 school districts and over 1,500 schools, a larger governmental operation than anything else we have in state government. But it varies from school districts that have the resources of what one of our small commissions would be to school districts that have the number of employees that the Department of Transportation has. So they vary greatly. When I first came here in 1997, the funding for K through 12 in state was about $4,205,000,000. And I think we did a little bitty measure, $50 million for textbooks and technology. We have made very little progress towards equalization at that time, and we were actually facing potential court issues over the fact that we had made very little progress. In 99, we went to either, depending on how you look at it, $4,561,000,000 or $4,811,000,000. The reason for those figures is the higher figures would be there if you include lottery bonds, I think that we are still repaying, that we used for technology, SB 22 technology dollars. You remember SB 622. We took out a little bit extra out of the Common School Fund, largely because we were pressured by the need to equalize school district funding at a faster rate and because we had lost additional revenue on the local side given the passage of Measure 47 and Measure 50. In 2001, as we went into that session and completed that session, many of us thought that we had finally actually started to bring K through 12 funding to a level that was at least beginning to start to be reasonable, and then we fell into a recession. We ended up at $4,689,000,000. You do not want to know how we got to $4,689,000,000. You never want to do a comparison on anything on the budget for 2001-2003. There's so much squishy money in there that you would not want to even report that you had anything to do with it. I didn't include the additional money that was available there because of our issue of allowing school districts to capture their payment in the following fiscal year in the previous biennium, which actually gave us the ability to say that we had done more than we had done. And fortunately, many school districts did not avail themselves of that basic trickery in accounting, and those that did, many of them have now paid that back and are on current schedules. Many of you were here also in 03, and 03 was largely a Band-Aid session. It was clearly a Band-Aid session. I was on the Public Safety Subcommittee at that time and the Public Safety and General Government Committee, and we basically kept public safety together with Band-Aids. And we didn't do much better on K through 12 education and funded it about $4,914,000,000. In 05, we saw the first light and things were starting to improve. To be honest, they were starting to improve a little bit. We funded K through 12 at $5,305,000,000. Then we got to 07, and we thought we were finally going to see the end of the tunnel and there was going to be light. And for the first time, we brought education funding to up to almost, but not quite, 80% of EBL. Of course, we have lost a portion of that given our cuts in education this year. And as we all know, in 09, we will be lucky to fund K through 12 at $6 billion in total, and that figure may be high for some of our discussions. That actually is going back down to about 72% of what the quality education model would require. The reason I bring this history up is you can see that it is not consistent, it is not sustainable. If you were a school administrator trying to take kids over that period from the time that they were in the first grade to the time they were in high school, you would have a very hard time meeting the goals that we have set for school districts also. SCR 38 may not be the remedy, but the problem is real. And even if we are in very difficult times now, I think it is incumbent on us to think about the future of this state and the role that education plays literally in all levels, whether it's economic, social, cultural, or whatever level you want to use. We have actually failed to adequately fund education. We have failed to consistently fund it. We have failed to sustainably fund it. Perhaps our current revenue system, and I wish Senator Morse was still here because he'd comment on that, is not adequate to adequately fund public education. But I do believe it's an issue that we cannot ignore, even as difficult as our times are now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you for keeping this issue alive and for keeping the discussion going. Questions of Senator Devlin, Senator Cruz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Devlin, 2 years from now, we are still in a recession. This is past, which would require us to go to 85%. Where do you take the money from? You know, I guess, Senator, my biggest issue here is we've always had the unenviable task of weighing human services versus education versus public safety, and with this, we are tilting the scale, are we not?
If we are still in recession, which I believe is a pretty fair assumption given what our current circumstances are, I believe it probably would tip the scale at that time. But I don't want to sound too much like I'm on the other side of the aisle here, but I've been speaking for a long time that if we have a revenue system, which is the revenue system that we've largely created both in this building and the public is largely created by the initiative system, then we probably should live within that revenue system, at least for the time being. But that means actually in all of our major budgets, we should not be increasing any of them beyond the levels that we would normally be able to sustain. And since our revenue system, I think the legislative revenue officer sometimes has used a figure of about 11%, that over a decade's period of time, you cannot count on an average of more than 11%. Obviously, we're going to be probably negative now in this coming biennium. You shouldn't be funding any programs at the level of increases that we have funded them in some previous sessions. I would point out that in the 07 session, although some people might think the K-12 funding was high, it was the lowest of the big three, actually. Human services was first, public safety was next, and education was third. Actually, first was a very small budget, that was DEQ, which was funded at a much higher level, but that was largely to replace federal dollars that had been withdrawn from the needs that DEQ tries to meet.
Other questions? Well, thank you. I think it's probably fair to say that by the time this is all said and done, we'll do some more squishy things to pass out our education budget this time, things that we probably won't want to revisit.
Or you won't want to remember.
We won't want to remember. Anyone else wishing to testify on SJR 38? Close the public hearing. And I'd like to open up an informational meeting on streamlining state reporting for kindergarten through 12. We have a couple of people who want to testify and show us, talk about some of the newer models that we're looking at in terms of efficiencies and streamlining. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For your record, my name is Doug Costi. I'm the Assistant Superintendent of Assessment and Information Services for the Department of Education. With me today is Craig Hawkins from the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, or COSA. COSA and the department have been working collaboratively on identifying ways to reduce the paperwork burden on schools and districts across the state. And we thought we would give you a brief information or presentation on what it is we're doing and where we're at with this work and where we're going with it. But before that, I thought I'd take an opportunity to give you a 2 to 3 minute overview of data collection in Oregon to build some perspective for this conversation. Prior to 1997, the data that the department collected was more paper-based than anything. So we received a lot of paper-based data collections, and we basically stuffed it in file folders, and it was really hard to get that information out and do anything with. In 97, the legislature adopted or passed a policy option package referred to as the Database Initiative Project. And with that, we moved from a paper-based data collection and reporting system to a web-based data collection system. In the years following that, a couple of additional things happened. The federal government moved to more granular data collection requirements in order for us to do reporting. So we were forced into collecting individual student and staff level data, which we do currently. This creates a huge burden on school districts to validate that information, push it up to us on a regular basis. In addition, we moved into a web-based testing environment, which required us to basically register every student in the state and provide access to a web-based testing infrastructure based on a unique identifier to allow us to process this information more quickly. Also occurring about that same time was an increase in federal and state accountability reporting. So at the state level, we have school and district performance reports that collect a wide gamut of information from schools and districts on performance, programs, participation, school student assessments, etc. Essentially, at this point, we're collecting about 60 million data points per year across the state, and we take that information and combine it to create report cards on 1,200 schools and about 200 districts and 20 ESDs to give you a kind of an idea of what we're doing and perception of what the districts are faced with. In 2007, the legislature approved a policy option package known as the Pre-K-12 Integrated Data System, otherwise known as KIDS. And the purpose of that initiative was to create a streamlined process for exchanging student transcript information, so records about students between schools and districts as kids moved around enterprise. It had a second benefit to it, or it has a second benefit to it, and that is we take that information at the student level, de-identify it, and put it into a warehouse for policy research purposes. We're planning on having that functionality rolled out in the early 2009-11 biennium, and people are now starting to look at that infrastructure as a way that we can start to reduce some of these other transactional-based data collection systems. So with that, we've had several conversations with schools and districts to kind of start the juices flowing in terms of how that would look and what options or opportunities we have to streamline the existing data collection format. So with that, I'm going to pass it over to Craig, if that's okay.
Thanks, Doug. As Doug said, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Craig Hawkins from COSA. Last year, over about 7 months, COSA and ODE partnered on an effort to bring school district personnel together and take a look at state reporting with the hope of finding some efficiencies. And we had a really interesting committee that offered a really diverse number of perspectives. There were 25, as I said, 25 school districts represented, but there were folks every place from someone who does data entry to superintendents and all points in between. And so that gave us a really nice set of perspectives on what it's really like to do state reporting and what issues are out there. The other thing I really wanted to say in this regard was that ODE had to do a lot of work to make this committee work. We looked at about 30 reports and collections in detail to get to the recommendations that we issued, and the amount of hours, time, and energy that ODE staff had to put in so that the committee could have the right background to make recommendations was a lot, and we really appreciate your efforts. I believe that you all have a copy of this publication. Your version may be black and white, but this is the recommendation publication from the group. And I just thought I'd highlight really quickly the recommendations. First of all, the group had about six recommendations that we got to work on right away. The department is actually has done these or is in process of doing these, even though the recommendations were issued late last year. And you can see that they've consolidated a number of collections and reports, and we found some real efficiencies there. In fact, got an email just the other day from one of the data folks at one of our smaller districts, and her note to me said, "Thank you for the changes that you made in this particular collection. The what used to take me a full day just took me a full hour." So nice positive step forward there. So those series of recommendations are underway. The second big area of recommendation was around communication, and a couple of key points there. One is that we have so many state and federal reports, and so much information goes to the public and others about performance of schools, et cetera, around these reports, that what's really important sort of gets lost in all of the mass of information. And so one of our recommendations is to really focus on what's important and to do some work in that regard. The other thing is that school districts really ask for sort of the rules for the year at a certain time so they can plan on exactly what to do and when and plan their data collection and reporting. And this is an issue not so much generated by ODE at all, really. It's more of a federal thing. Federal folks change rules in mid-year, which causes lots of extra work at the school district level. So we're hoping to be able to take that on and do something about that. The third piece is around the whole mandate burden on school districts and ESDs. One note is that at this point, between our estimate is that between 500 and 1,000 full-time employees, the equivalent of full-time employees, work on state reporting, state and federal reporting in the state and schools and ESDs. When we were doing this work last year, we were in a little bit of a different climate. We were looking for efficiencies in state reporting, but today finding those efficiencies may be more important than ever. And we are just about to launch round two with a smaller work group to look for more pieces of streamlining. That work actually starts tomorrow, and we're looking forward to getting into that. Really, the goal of that group is it's simple, but it may not be easy. It's to identify the next five things. Really simple. You've got the publication, but just wanted to make sure you were aware of the work.
Well, I appreciate that. On the things that you've started already, is there any way to quantify cost savings, or is there any way to quantify any kind of time savings or things that are already
Do you have anything on that?
Been done?
Well, if the email is correct on the one saving, know, I guess that's 7 hours times 200 school districts. But, no, I don't think at this point we really do, because many of them are still in process.
And something I feel to recognize Chair Haas, members of the committee, was that the stimulus funds that we're about to receive or are, you know, being prepared have a whole new set of data collection and reporting requirements that come with them. And that's something we have to balance as part of this conversation that we have going forward. We, at this point, we don't even know how much impact or cost that's going to place on the districts over and above what they're already doing.
Questions, Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this information to us. I'm looking at the number two, establish a communications committee piece, and noted that part of the recommendation is to be charged with ensuring that communication of state federal reporting provides Oregonians, educators, and policymakers with a clear, fair, focused, and accurate picture of school and student performance. And I really appreciate that piece, and I guess this is a comment rather than a question, although I could ask it as a question. In communicating with Oregonians about this piece, I think it's also critical to tie into the, for example, the information that's on the Open Books Project about how schools are spending resources, because I find when I'm in my community, which is most of my district is in the Beaverton and Portland school districts, I found that people still don't understand what the money is used for in public schools, and I think that it is connected to this, rather than just focusing on the streamlining and here's how we're saving money, to have that message also be, and here's how we're using the funds that we have. I'm surprised to find out that people think that 30 to 40% of school district budgets go to administration. And so I think it's important to tie it in with how the money is being spent. Here's what we're doing to streamline, but here's what we're doing with the money that we have. So I trust that you're coordinating with the communication piece in that regard as well.
Chairman Haas, Senator Bonamici, I just wanted to mention that recommendation came out of kind of a parallel track. There was a group meeting during the same time called the Accountability Roundtable, and they were focused on that specific topic, and part of their recommendation was that we build that really focused communication piece around how our schools are doing, and it would include the very same kind of information that the chalkboard board provides on Open Books as part of those four or five really key things that the public needs to know about their schools. So we're tracking in the same way.
Thank you. Senator Morris. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little bit at a loss to understand the lack of urgency. We're in a financial crisis, and we need to be thorough, we need to be thoughtful, but we also need to be expeditious. And if we have 1,000 employees that are taking staff away from classrooms and improvement initiatives, if you biannualize that and just make an assumption, if my math is correct, if you assume a $45,000 base and a 50% OPE, you're looking at roughly $130 million per biennium. That is no small sum of money that could go into, you know, the classroom, teachers, resources, all of those things that really count. And I'm wondering, how do we move this thing forward so that, that we can capture those efficiencies? That's why we're here.
Go ahead. Chairman Haas, Senator Morse, I think absolutely. I mean, anytime we can move from 1,000 folks doing state reporting to some smaller number and the rest going into the classroom, for example, seems like a really positive thing to do. I think that's why we're meeting tomorrow, is that first step to take maybe some bolder steps. When the work was done last year, we weren't in the same place. The climate wasn't the same. It's much different today. And I think when we identify the next five things, and we're planning to move very quickly, those things may be at, you know, sort of the next rung up from the recommendations that we've issued so far.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, you're looking at 10 priority bills, and I'd be willing to bet you could pry at least one priority bill out of this committee to get something moving in this biennium that would meaningfully affect how we fund, you know, direct services into education, not the indirects. I'm reminded of a comment that was made in a previous session that we seem to spend a lot of effort weighing the lamb, but we should spend a little more effort in feeding the lamb. And that has stuck in my mind, and this certainly brings it to the forefront right here. You know, Mr. Chair, if there are things we can do, we just have to be doing them. And that would be my encouragement. I'll give you a priority bill.
Thank you.
Senator Metzger?
Well, my only observation would be, I think along Frank's line is, you know, focusing on something. And I heard you say about a smaller group working on it. It just seemed almost like an oxymoron that the paperwork reduction and streamlining task force was 38 people. I mean, it just seemed like it was just the opposite of streamlining. And I know nothing gets done. It's hard to get done with 15 people, and 38 is whatever. So I would only say, Mr. Chair, the Senator has... Senator Morris's comment about, you know, picking some key issue with some key folks and getting it done. Otherwise, it does become circular and never-ending and probably doesn't get focused. But I appreciate at least identifying the issues, but I would agree. Find an issue and see what we might be able to do to help with that.
Will do.
Thank you both for coming forward with this report.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We'll close the informational hearing. And we're going to kind of move and skip through the program here. Senator Monis Anderson is here, and we have a traffic jam of state senators back there. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 533, moving from schools to shopping carts.
And she is the queen of shopping carts,
let me tell you.
Thank you, Chair Hass and members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Monis Anderson, and I'm a senator from Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, and Fairview. And I know there are a lot of pressing issues on this state. This is a very simple bill, so it shouldn't really take very much of your time at all. In 2007, we did pass a shopping cart bill. Littering of shopping carts, basically, and in my community, was a really huge concern. And when the Northwest Grocery Association came forward with this concept, I jumped on it because I had numerous constituents telling me the problem with shopping carts in their neighborhoods. Basically, this is just a technical fix from last session's shopping cart bill, and that bill created a public-private partnership in collecting abandoned shopping carts, and it actually set parameters for model shopping cart ordinances to be adopted by local governments. Even though the bill's working very well, I'll have the proponents of the bill come forward to tell you in more detail what the loophole was that we need to close. I just want to end my testimony by saying last month, under this program, the total carts retrieved were 3,482, and there were actually 272 calls to the hotline. And when you look, since this started being implemented in October 07, this is actually really working in our communities. It's just that there are some stores with shopping carts that aren't participating, and I'll let the proponents explain that. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Senator, did you say 3,000? Is that statewide?
Statewide.
Questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thanks.
Ms. Anderson. Sean Miller. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in support of Senate Bill 533. I know the League of Oregon Cities could not be here today, but they are also supporting the bill, and we've worked this bill out with them. And on the testimony that I give you, and I will not read through, because we do view this as a technical cleanup from last session's bill that I know went through Senator Metzger's committee. But on the second page of the testimony, which Senator Montes Anderson references, gives you the idea of how the program is working. And what it does is we run this cart retrieval service in the Portland area, the Valley, Albany, and even as far as Grants Pass. So we run it down, and even though we put together a model ordinance which cities can adopt, I can tell you from the Portland area has not really adopted it currently, because we're already doing this. We're essentially doing this in the entire Portland metro area. But cities that have adopted this are Albany, Beaverton, who actually came and testified last session, Grants Pass in Milwaukee, Gresham, Salem, Tigard, Tualatin, and Fairview are next. And so what we did is in the bill we created an indemnity for those stores who actually participate with all the requirements in Chapter 199-891. We thought that just having or participating and having a cart retrieval service would actually force them to actually comply with the entire law and actually grant them indemnity from stricter city ordinances. And what we found out is it doesn't necessarily do that. We intended to actually put all of the requirements in 199-891, which are at the bottom of my testimony, which is the sign requirements. So you actually have a sign on the cart, the toll-free number, which could either be the 1-800 number that works basically statewide, the program that we run, or in some cities, again, you don't have to join this program, you could be your local phone number. I know that's how Albany has put their city ordinance together, and so which we've actually testified in support in all of those cities. And so, like I said, the program is running very successful. By the numbers that you see, that is statewide, but those are only in the cities that really have issues. You know, we really don't have shopping cart issues in some of the smaller cities, so most of that, those numbers on the second page, I would say, is the Portland metropolitan area and Salem. And the need for this bill was really driven by the neighborhood associations. Even though it doesn't seem like a big, hot issue, it is a big issue when in neighborhood associations when you have carts littered in your neighborhood. And so, Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that. And, again, we support the bill and hope it moves through the process. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Did you say Portland is not participating?
No.
Portland is.
Mr. Chairman, Portland does not have their own city ordinance, but our program, cart retrieval program, and we're voluntarily doing exactly what's in the statute in the entire Portland metropolitan area. So, in essence, they don't have a city ordinance, but they don't really need to, since all of our stores most of our stores are doing it. Again, there's few stores that may not be doing some of the signage requirements, in which case, if a cart is left in a stream or in somebody's neighborhood, there's really no way to identify that. I think that's what we left up to cities to do some stricter enforcement if they don't comply with the bill, and that was our intent.
So could you just very briefly walk us through how it works now, not overly complicated, just a hypothetical composite kind of?
Yeah, well, right now, the way it works now, if someone leaves the store with a cart, and which, again, is theft. I mean, let's be real honest. When you take a cart off property, it's stolen property. But it's been a difficult situation. Obviously, law enforcement isn't going to be arresting people in this day and age of stealing shopping carts. We recognize that it's our responsibility. It's very costly. I mean, it's between $150 to $300, depending on the cart and the store. So when you look up, it's in our best interest to get our carts back and clean them so the customers can use. But when the cart leaves the property and ends up in a neighborhood, they don't return the cart. On the cart is a 1-800 number or a toll-free number that they can call. And, again, the program that we run is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They call that number and say, I have a cart at my house. We have contracted with a cart retrieval service that actually does routes, because they know where all the hot spots are in Portland, where a lot of carts end up. But, again, if it's in some obscure place like next to your house, if you call that number, we'll have and get that cart actually right away. And then if it's a Fred Meyer cart, it's returned to Fred Meyer. If it's a Safeway cart. And so what we put down in the statute is essentially a criteria, signage requirement, And it was in our best interest, and we realized that the private sector can do this better, pool their money and figure out, versus a city or different cities trying to enact their own ordinances or getting into the cart retrieval business themselves. And I think the cities realized this, even though we put a preemption in the state law, we did say that if you are not complying with this, cities can do stricter penalties. So they can actually then fine somebody if they're not, you know, a retailer that just fails to participate or fails to do their part. And we felt that was necessary. And again, most of the retailers are signing up. And what we figured in the private sector, by creating this program and having a cart retrieval service that gets it for the majority of all the retailers, it is much more cost effective for each store to do it that way than to do it themselves, to have individual cart retrieval services and pay for that. So it was in our best interest, it was in the neighborhood association's best interest, and the city's best interest. And when we had these meetings with several stakeholders, and we came up essentially with the bill from last session, and all we're doing really is that indemnity feature, where all we said last session was that you had to have a cart retrieval service and to be essentially indemnified. And we left out some of those requirements on the posting the signs on the cart, the phone number. I think very, very minor things, but very important to the neighborhood associations and actually for us to even run this program.
Questions? Senator Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean, I'm just trying to understand how the change that's in the bill on lines 13 and 14 addresses what you, I understand what you're trying to do, and I'm just trying to figure out how it does that by changing the language.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, on lines 14, when you look at 199.891, which is the bottom of my testimony,
right.
I just printed that out. If you look at D, where it deletes D, and so you'd have to comply with all the elements of 1 when we delete that D. And so before, you only had to have retrieve or contract for the retrieval of abandoned shopping carts to essentially not be able to, a city can have stricter penalties to a retailer that did just complied with that, and we felt we needed all of those elements.
I got it. Thank you. I was missing the italics.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 533 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 533.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 533 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 533 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and Senator Monis Anderson would be a good carrier for this bill, I believe. Okay.
I believe.
Said he's here for 648. I'd like to open up a public hearing for Senate Bill 648, and Senator Morissette is in the back of the room. Dana?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 648 permits one or more school districts or electors of one or more school districts to petition for proposed boundary change or merger of school districts. And it requires the County District Boundary Board to mediate discussions that are held between districts. We have a -1 amendment before us that sets out more of the mediation process between districts that are requesting boundary changes.
Senator Morissette,
thank you for coming here. Thank you, Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. Mr. Chair and Committee, the reason that I brought this before you today is because of a discussion that I had with the former superintendent of the Springfield School District, Jamin Kent, about the discussion with the 4J School District concerning boundary change. Now, the city of Springfield, there are a number of students who live in the city of Springfield who go to the 4J district. Traditionally, they've done that. We have looked at, when I was mayor of Springfield, we had a discussion several times about incorporating them into the city of Springfield. Superintendent Kent said, well, the problem is it's hard to get 4J to talk with us. And he met with, he said, I've had a lot of discussions with George Russell, who is the current superintendent of 4J, and neither one of us want to bring it up. We both think it needs to be talked about, but, you know, if I bring it up, then people are going to get, you know, get angry with me, and if he brings it up, his district will get angry with him, particularly if they're the ones who would lose students. So this bill is simply to require that a districts, okay, if a district says, I want to talk with Superintendent so-and-so about a boundary change under the current law, Superintendent so-and-so would say, I don't want to talk about it. Go through the process, so on, bring in all your stuff. But this gives superintendents an opportunity to sit down and discuss the issue, and if they decide nothing, they don't want to talk about it. If one superintendent says, no, I'm not interested after hearing your compelling arguments, I'm still not interested in a boundary change, then it goes back to the existing law. So the purpose of this is simply to facilitate the discussion, and that's it.
Questions? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment, lines 4 and 5, one or more school districts may request a proposed boundary change or a merger of school districts or the electors of one or more school districts. And I just very quickly was reading through the amendments. Have we identified how electors would initiate this process? Is that clear in the bill?
Yeah. Well, the existing bill says that if at the front end, electors could, I imagine they could gather a petition, go to the ESD and say, we want to initiate a boundary change through a signature gathering, and they would then be given the forms to go out and gather signatures, and that would initiate the discussion for a boundary change. Now, in the event that school districts agreed to a boundary change, the electorate of one school district can get a remonstrance against a boundary change. They can gather signatures and put it up to it. It has to be voted on by both districts. If it's challenged, it has to be voted on. The smaller district would have their vote first, and then the larger district would have a vote, and it would be a majority of each district to concur. So
5% or 500.
So that's the way the system works. And so this bill doesn't touch the system. It simply says, let's talk about it. And I know I thought there might be, you know, districts from other parts of the state here concerned with this issue. I know that as urban growth boundaries increase and as cities' boundaries increase and there's a community of interest within the district, which is important, I think this would facilitate those discussions.
Thank you, Mr. DeFranco. Senator Morris.
Just, if I might, have a little bit of humor. Do you have fluoride in your water?
Not yet.
Well, I remember it seems like these boundary issues come up between Springfield and Eugene quite frequently. Yes. And I recall a bill that we had last session that we adjudicated essentially a boundary issue.
Yeah, there was
boundary commission issue.
Okay.
So
at one time there was a difference of opinion about daylight saving time, and Eugene didn't want to switch over with Springfield did, and that lasted for about 6 months, and then we reconciled our differences. Excuse me. While last session, the city of Springfield did separate itself from Eugene in terms of our urban growth boundary, because we are more of a pro-growth city, and the city of Eugene is less interested in growth. But anyway, that's a different issue. But yeah, there are some differences.
Mr. DeFranco, could you lay out the problem you experienced and how this would address it?
Great. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Currently, in Springfield School District, as our community has grown and our patterns of residents have shifted, our boundary.
Could you start off with your name?
Oh, sorry. My name is Jeff DeFranco. I'm the Director of Communications and Facilities for Springfield Public Schools. Currently, in our community, in our district, as our city's grown and our community's grown and our urban growth boundary has shifted, as you referred to, students in our school district are in our city are not always served by our school district. And as we've looked at these issues, actually our community leaders approached the district, both our mayor and our president of the Chamber of Commerce, and asked us to look at a way that we could work with our neighboring districts to ensure that Springfield students are educated in Springfield Public Schools. And so this is actually an issue that's not only important to the district, but the community as a whole would like to see a community where their students attend schools and the same students that play in local sporting groups together attend the same schools. The people that are neighbors and that are part of the community are invested in that community and the district. Specifically in Springfield, there are two areas that are that have these issues. And what I would say is that Springfield is not unique in this. This is really common as you look throughout the state. There are a number of boundary lines that made a lot of sense at the time, but as the communities have grown, they no longer really line up with the community. And in Springfield, we have a partnership called Team Springfield with our city, our utility board, our park and recreation district, and the school district, and we work on shared goals and priorities. And as you have these little pockets that are outside of our shared service area, it creates an interesting challenge for the district on how to allocate those shared resources of Team Springfield as we try and meet the needs of the students in those affected communities. Specifically, there are two areas, one in our Gateways area that I mentioned here that is in a neighboring school district. And many of those students are actually bused right by one of our schools to the neighboring school district. And then the second one involves an urban growth boundary expansion that as the city is continuing to grow into one area, it'll actually be growing out of our school district. And so you'll have a small percentage of that urban growth boundary where families will still live in Springfield but not be served by Springfield students. When we had opportunity to speak with Senator Morissette, you know, our issue is not necessarily to look for a legislative resolution to our individual boundary, but more so to create a process that would allow us as a single district to request a meeting of the districts to look at these specific issues. One thing that we've seen, I think there's sometimes assumptions that individual districts or boards might have about how you're looking to implement, such as, you know, we want all students to immediately come to our district, or we want to cancel your bond tax base that's in this district. And really what we believe is if we were able to get to the table and there was a process that ensured that we were able to get to the table, you would see that potentially you could find and work toward common ground. And really our core value is just the ability to educate Springfield students in Springfield. And if that took a 12-year transition to allow students to matriculate to through the system, or, you know, 15 years for a bond measure for that taxing to complete for another district, we would be willing to look at that long-term approach. But really why we're in support of this Senate Bill 648 is because it provides a clear venue and process to jump right into conversations. And, you know, I think other than that, just in closing, you know, just to point out a few of the examples we have through our utility board and energy education program, through our after-school program, through our park district, we have an after-school program. So you could see as these, as our boundary is not able to line up with their boundary, it creates an issue for services for students. And that's really the ultimate goal here, is to make sure that we could best serve our students in our community and have the opportunity to move forward with that. Any questions?
Questions, committee? Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Call up Tricia Yates, Chuck Bennett.
No, I'm just going to get that one.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the Senate Education Committee. For the record, I'm Tricia Yates with the Oregon School Boards Association. We represent the state's 1,400 volunteer elected education leaders in school districts, community colleges, and ed service districts in the state. Mr. Bennett and I are here today to just speak for information about Senate Bill 648. As state associations, or at least I'll speak for OSBA, the process that we're talking about with school district boundary changes, the current law provides a kind of an equal playing field as we see it for school districts. I can tell you as a state association, we have not received a number of complaints about the current process in which school district boundary changes or mergers will be considered by the local ESD if all affected school districts support the proposed boundary change or merger. We think that makes some good sense for resolution and collaboration at the local level. We do have a concern about the bill potentially creating a contentious process among districts. You have to, if you compel one district to go forward. I think the original bill, as I understand it, sets up a required mediated discussion, and if you reach an impasse, it doesn't force the process forward unless the mediation is successful, whereas the dash one, as I understand it, takes the mediation, even if it's not successful, moves the process one step forward. And I guess as an association, we're not hearing a great deal of demand for it. Perhaps there's a local situation where folks may not like the outcome of a request to consider this, and maybe it should stay as a local issue. And I'd like to offer it to Mr. Bennett to share some more thoughts.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Ms. Chairman, just a couple of thoughts. Number one, school district boundaries and urban growth boundaries just are not the same, and nor were they set up to be the same. And I think and city limits as well, and although it is really convenient, I guess, when the two are coincidental, I think that it would be one of those accidents of history around the state that the two are the same. We don't have city school districts, very few county school districts. So I think that is a compelling reason to establish this process. It would be one that would be kind of tricky. There are a couple of other issues I just want to make sure are on the table. And let's just look at the example of Eugene and Springfield school districts. I think there are sort of historical financial issues that come into play here that need to be at least looked at to determine a kind of equity, determine if you want to make this decision statewide, because I would suggest these kinds of issues exist around the state in various possibilities when you put legislation like this in place. Gateway is an enterprise zone. Glenwood, another part of the area under discussion, is an urban renewal area. In both cases, the school district, in this case 4J, has agreed to have or has been part of the process that had taxes frozen at a certain level based its anticipated return on increased valuation on the increment in the taxation, if you will. To move that now would be in some ways pretty unfair. They have dealt with whatever time the taxes were frozen. Now the taxes begin to move up. If there is a change in the zone or in the status of the urban renewal district, the beneficiary would be Springfield, while 4J took all the loss, if there is a loss in this case. So I think you need to look at that, very carefully look at various kinds of debt that districts have incurred, and I know it's mentioned in the bill. And otherwise, this is just a fine bill, the original bill. It just asks people to talk. Well, it goes a little further than that, but not much further. It requires a whole new process at the ESD, because that's the boundary board we're talking about. The ESD becomes a mediator, and it contemplates mediation sessions, which is not something at this point that ESDs are set up for. Right now, ESDs in the boundary process really are an electoral board. They deal purely with the election. They do
The experiences that I've had with this kind of question, they do nothing around the issues involved. They merely manage the election to allow the two districts to deal with the boundary dispute and the boundary change. So it is a new job for the ESDs, and I'm sorry the ESDs aren't here to talk about whether they want to have the job, although it is not totally outside of the possibilities for them. There's certainly a place that school districts meet on other issues. But otherwise, Mr. Chairman, it has some really interesting ideas in it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions of our panel here, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. The bill itself deals with just school districts making requests. The amendment goes beyond school districts. And as an example, a few years ago, there was a dispute in my part of the world where the kids up in Tokadee, who are part of the Glide School District, wanted to become part of a different school district just because of the mileage. And that didn't happen. So with the amendment, I'm trying to figure out how this would work, because they could petition by the amendment to enter into a discussion, but then at the same token, you're dealing with them wanting to leave one school district to enter another and leave one ESD to enter another. So how would the logistics on something like that work?
Well, Ms. Go ahead.
Senator Bill Moore said, I don't think it would matter. I don't. This is not an inter-ESD bill. This is within a particular ESD. So school districts within an ESD could access this kind of negotiation, but not, this does not address one ESD to another.
Well, Mr. Chair,
were you directing your question to
But the point, Senator, is the fact that the situation I have described, those students were part of the Glide School District in one ESD, and they're wanting to go to the Lapine School District, which is in another ESD. So then it becomes a matter of jurisdiction, who's convening. So, I mean, you see what I'm saying?
Okay. My take on this bill is it deals with an ESD that has two districts within their boundaries that want to discuss boundary change, and it doesn't address inter-boundary changes between ESDs. Now, ESD boundaries will change, and then there's a whole new ball game in terms of the school districts that they may be involved. If we go to 11 ESDs, that's going to change significantly. But this is to facilitate discussion, and it doesn't preclude or it doesn't require any resolution to the discussion. It's just to get the two districts at the table to discuss. Now, the Marcola School District is interesting because they are within, they're adjoining the Springfield School District, and there may be a discussion between those two school districts, and one of them may not want to talk and the other one may, but it could be for the benefit of both of them. So this is just a facilitation bill. It doesn't require anything other than the two districts sitting down discussing their concerns.
Senator Morissette, on that point, How do you compel school districts to participate? How do you know whether they're acting in good faith? Who decides?
The purpose of this bill is to get them to sit across the table from one another, and once they sit across the table from one another, it may not last very long. That it's to bring the other district to the table, and the district could come and say, hey, I don't want to be here. The law says I have to be here. Go ahead and tell me what you want, and they can then leave, you know. I think, though, 99% of the time school districts would come together in good faith, knowing that there was no there was nothing to compel them to take action. But it's getting the discussion going that I think is the important thing, and if a school district doesn't ever want to talk about it, then they're never going to be able to get together.
Okay. Any other questions to our witnesses here or our sponsor? And Senator Morissette, you came back up here to say something.
Well, I just wanted to come up here to say that Chuck Bennett said this was a good bill.
Thank you. And I have Chris Beck signed up to testify. Former Representative Chris Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chris Beck, and resident of unincorporated Multnomah County. I'm here on behalf of my neighbors. We have a similar sort of issue that we are hoping to bring to the legislature, either the House or the Senate, in the next in the waning days here, regarding our neighborhood, which is an unincorporated island in Multnomah County. We are currently and within the Portland School District, but our neighborhood borders the Lake Oswego School District, and our schools, we have also have a Lake Oswego address, but we aren't incorporated, and Lake Oswego schools are much closer to our neighborhood. So we're trying to figure out whether there is a way that we can establish through legislation a choice of attending either Portland or Lake Oswego schools without actually changing any ESD boundaries or changing school district boundaries. We have some legislation drafted with the help of Representative Garrett, who's our House member, and we are looking for a legislative bill we could bring to a committee, either House or Senate, and see if there's a way to have a discussion in committee. This is a bill that would be appropriate. However, it's different enough, and Senator Morissette doesn't want his bill complicated by something we bring, and we certainly defer to Senator Morissette about that. So we're looking for other bills that come through the system where we can have a little more substantive dialogue. And I also want to say we are working with the Portland School District to see if there is some kind of non-legislative remedy to this situation. But I just come up here to remind you probably don't need the reminders, that these situations are occurring in different ways all over the state, like Senator Cruz's situation and ours and the one in Lane County. So, you know, I don't know that there are macro solutions that fit everybody's situation, but we are trying to find a narrow way to deal with our island of 35 homes that is that would be more fitting for our neighborhood. So I don't have legislation. You probably don't have any questions, but if you...
It just seems to me that if there's anybody that could get those two sides talking together in good faith, it would be you.
Well, we're working on that. I appreciate that.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, you mentioned that you had talked with the districts. Is this something that they just don't want to do, or can't they do it under the existing statute?
They can have inter-district transfer agreements, and many districts do. Lake Oswego will allow people, children in our neighborhood, to go to Lake Oswego, but Portland will not release their school fund money. So Lake Oswego has to charge tuition for kids to go 3/4 of a mile to Lake Oswego High School. Our closest Portland High School is 3.5 miles away, and impossible to get to on bike for distance and terrain and transportation reasons. Portland has a policy of not releasing its students to other districts. They may have some situations where they do allow it, but they generally Portland won't do it. Lake Oswego is happy to take the kids if they can get the state money. So I think Portland is, I don't want to fault them. I mean, they have good reasons for not wanting to do it. In this case, we're talking about less than 20 students at any given time. The legislation we're drafting is really tailored to this unique geographical location, which we were able to do with legislative counsel. And we're trying to create choice. In a sense, it is maybe a pilot proposal for people being able to live in one district but have a choice between the host district and an adjacent district. So it would be kind of maybe a test to see if those sorts of things work. I don't think everybody in our neighborhood would flock to Lake Oswego. Some kids are going to stay in Portland. Some will go to Oswego. Some will go to private schools, as they do now. So I don't... wouldn't be a big financial impact on Portland, and maybe we can work something out with them. But so far, Portland, whenever a parent has applied for an inter-district transfer, they've been denied.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 648, and I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 871. We have Nikki Terziev here to give us the lowdown on this bill in Dash 1 amendments.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nikki Terziev. I'm here on behalf of the Jewish Federation of Portland. Thank you very much for having me. I'm sorry I wasn't as riveting, I guess, as the last bill. I've kind of cleared out the room here. But I did want to talk through the Dash 1s very briefly, just for the interest of time. The idea and the intent behind this bill is to ensure and assure some funding for security fixtures and installations for facilities that are constituent properties of the Jewish Federation of Portland. It would be the community centers, the day schools, the summer camps, and health centers, health campuses. This bill, this amendment, the Dash 1s, is incorporated as a kind of a friendly gut and stuff, and it really just authorizes the Department of Emergency Management to seek out grants, federal grants, private grants, that will be then assigned to and allocated to the Jewish Federation to build fences, put in cameras, intercom systems, and otherwise assure the security of these facilities.
Okay. And committee, you know, this is a Brian Boquist bill, who was very interested in the emergency management and homeland security ramifications here. Any questions, Senator Bonavici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question and then a comment. Nikki, on the Dash 1 amendments, on line 15, it talks about how the Oregon Military Department shall disperse monies received under Section 1 of the section for the purpose of strengthening security in and around the facilities of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. I just want a little clarification on the record to make sure that you aren't asking disbursement of all of the funds that are in that particular account to the facilities of the Jewish Federation, but rather specific funds that are designated for that purpose. Is
Chair
that
Haas, Senator Bonamici, that is correct. The monies that are found through the grants that are applied for in Section 1 are what goes into this kind of holding account, which is identified in Section 2, which is then doled back out.
Thank you. And then the comment that I wanted to make, Mr. Chair and committee, is that when this bill in its original form raised some concern about whether it was a religious organization that was seeking federal money, and I have some personal experience with many of these facilities. I was a member of the Jewish Community Center for many years. My kids went to preschool there. My parents, who are not Jewish, are members there. My father-in-law lived in the Robeson Jewish home in the Roschnitzer Manor apartment, which is part of the property. I believe that's a question here. And many, they all have non-discrimination policies, and many of the people who are either using this facilities, visiting, or working in the facilities are not Jewish. They're not religious institutions or not synagogues. I think there's a little chapel in a couple of them, but they're not religious buildings necessarily.
Places of worship.
They're not people worship in them, but people worship in many places.
Here.
But, yes. Right. That's right. So I wanted to put that on the record, particularly with the Middleman Jewish Community Center. It's a community center that's used by many people in the community who aren't Jewish, and the members and the employees certainly deserving of safety. You, I'm sure, are aware of some of the issues where Jewish community centers in Seattle in particular and other places have been targets, and so there is a significant amount of concern. So I just wanted to put that on the record, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Morse?
No.
Ready to go?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 871.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments. Any discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 871 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 871 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral of the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Any discussion?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I agree that it isn't really an issue that needs to go to Ways and Means because the purpose of it is to set up this structure to gather particular funding. I understand there's some federal money that may be appropriate, so it isn't really a Ways and Means issue. So
I would agree.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Any objections to this bill to do pass recommendation? Seeing none. So ordered. And Senator Boquist, the appropriate carrier for this?
Okay.
And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 871, and we're just going to refer this next bill.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 726 for the purpose of referring to Committee on Finance and Revenue. Dana?
Senate Bill 726 permits the government of an eligible Indian tribe to request that the Economic and Community Development Department designate one reservation trust land zone. As you mentioned today, we are just hearing this bill for the purpose of forwarding it to the Finance and Revenue Committee, I believe, without recommendation.
Senator Morris?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 726 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Finance and Revenue by prior reference.
Senator Morse moves Senate Bill 726 without recommendation as to passage to the Committee on Finance and Revenue by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 726. If there is no further business before our committee, we are adjourned.